Welcome to the second episode of the Narrators Podcast for September. Right off the bat, I want to do some quick thanks. I want to thank Jeff Barr and Kevin Allison of the Risk Podcast. I want to thank Alyssa Rogers for turning the Risk Podcast on to me. I want to thank my partner, Natalie Winslow, for handling all of the technical aspects of this podcast. And I want to thank my friend Karen Correa for the music in this podcast and future podcasts. So, with all those thanks out of the way, let's get on to the show.
This is The Narrators. This is a storytelling show where people tell true stories from their lives on a theme. And tonight's theme is time served. In August of 2001, I moved from Denver to Lodi, New Jersey. My intention was to move to New York, but I found out that Lodi was just across the river from New York, and rents were like an eighth of the price. And it was like a 15-minute bus ride into the city. So I moved from, it was the first time I'd ever moved away from Colorado, and I moved there. I had saved up about $7,000, and I didn't have a job lined up or anything. I was like, well, I'll just have some fun for a little while, and just experience New York. So I spent all of August taking the bus into New York City, eating in restaurants all day, partying all night. By the end of August, I'd blown about $3,000. Just pretty much on partying, and I don't do cocaine, so that's like drinking and cab rides in a month, like about $3,000. Just gross, a gross, gross waste of money. On Sunday, September 9th, I was on a rooftop party in Brooklyn. We were just across the East River from the Twin Towers, and I was laying on this roof, really drunk. I was looking at the Twin Towers. They were like basically right overhead. And I was joking about how they had aircraft warning lights halfway up them. They have them at the top, but they also had them halfway up. And somebody at the party was like, well, that's in case it's really foggy. You know, they also have the lights halfway there. And I was like, if you don't know that you're flying over Manhattan, you know, you probably shouldn't be flying a plane in the first place. And everybody's laughing. So two mornings later, on 9/11, my roommate comes into my room and wakes me up. I was asleep, and he was like, dude, wake up. We're under attack, dude. This is the amount of emotion that he put into it, literally. Dude, wake up. We're under attack. And I was like, at first I was like the apartment itself? Like, what's happening? Like, I know I'm the only non-Italian person in this town. I didn't think that they'd come for me like this. So I went into the living room, and I walked in literally just in time to watch the second tower fall, like live on TV. And I was like, what the fuck? So I spent the whole day just watching the news coverage, like pretty much everybody probably did that day. The only time I left my house was to go to Blockbuster to return some movies, because I was like, if there's any company that would still fuck me on late fees on 9/11... it's Blockbuster. Blockbuster, I could see, would be like, well, it's, you know, it's the rule. It's in the computer. So, and I remember how, like, eerily silent the whole town was. There was no planes. No one was driving. It was like this weird New Jersey town with no one outside, just like me walking around. It was really, really creepy, but, like, peaceful at the same time. It was this really weird combination of being super terrified and like realizing that everything was like really peaceful just for that day and right then. So 2 days later, that Thursday, I took the bus into New York to visit my best friend Karen, who lived in Queens. Normally, that bus ride took me about 15 minutes, and it took over 90 minutes. There were so many checkpoints to go through the Lincoln Tunnel, which, if you don't know, goes under the Hudson River from New Jersey into New York. And it was only me on the bus. I was the only person apparently jonesing to go into New York City 2 days after 9/11. It's only me on the bus. And as we're riding through the tunnel, the bus driver pointed out these numbers posted on the walls of the tunnel. He was like, do you see these numbers, how they're going down? He's like, they go down until you reach halfway through the tunnel, and then they start going up. He's like, pay really close attention to these numbers when you're in this tunnel. That way, if you see water coming down the tunnel, you'll know which way to run to get to the closest emergency exit. And I literally said, if I see water coming down this tunnel, I'm going to be way too busy screaming and shitting my pants on this bus to run in either direction. That would be like the most terrifying thing I can think of, to be on a bus under a river and seeing water coming in, and then I would like outrun it like in a movie or something. Like, that would never ever happen. You'd have to have a jet ski in the back of the bus or something for that to ever work. So I got off the bus and I was walking around in Manhattan, and there were still ashes in the air. This is 2 days later. There were still ashes in the air, sort of like snow, or if somebody was like blow drying something around, and I was breathing them in, and I remember feeling how creepy it was to breathe in ashes from the Twin Towers. I was like, this is like either that building or it's like people that I'm inhaling. And it was like really disgusting. So I like put my shirt over my face, and I visited my friend and stayed there for a few days. And then a couple days after that, I was on a bus also going into New York City. This was probably, I don't know, 4 days later. And there were more people in the bus, maybe like 10, but there was a Middle Eastern guy in the bus who was crying and praying in Arabic like so earnestly, and everybody on this bus is like staring at this guy. You could not pay more attention to someone than everyone on this bus was paying attention to this guy, and everyone is just like terrified of him. He's like so upset, you know, his eyes are closed, and he's just repeating what I assumed was a prayer in Arabic. Terrified everyone. But I remember at the time, I was really afraid too. But at the time, I was like, this poor guy, he probably either knows someone who was beaten up, or he has a relative in a country that we might be bombing soon. So as scary as this feels for me, it's probably 1,000 times scarier for him. So it was like, I was feeling like this compassion for this guy, while I was also feeling like the ugliest kind of like fear, hate you can feel for somebody at the same time. But I just remember everybody on that bus, like no broken eye contact at all. Like, don't do anything weird, please. And the guy didn't do anything weird. He was just bummed. Really bummed. So about a week after 9/11, there was an anthrax scare. I don't know if you remember this. It was a much bigger deal if you lived in New York or New Jersey. Somebody mailed envelopes with anthrax in them, and it killed like 5 people. And one of those post offices was in New Jersey. So because I have anxiety and I'm just crazy and a hypochondriac in general, I started to worry like maybe I had come in contact with some sort of anthrax envelope, because I felt shitty. You know, I had like a runny nose. I had like a cold, basically. But in this, like, you know, in this, like, fear-mongering post 9/11 fear incubator, I was like, this could also be anthrax. So I went to see a doctor, and he was like, well, what's going on? What's wrong with you? And I said, I don't know, I just feel crappy. And I'll never, for the rest of my life, I'll never forget what he said. He said, you feel crappy? Everybody feels crappy. And he just gave me this, like, disgusted look, like, what the fuck are you doing in my office? At the time, I thought he meant, like, you feel crappy, everybody just feels crappy all the time. Like, it's not a big deal, you just feel crappy. But then I realized, you know, it's a week after 9/11 in New Jersey. He's probably like, you come in here because you have the sniffles, and you think you feel crappy. That was, like, the best thing I think a doctor could ever say. Like, it would have been terrible if he was like, oh, you feel crappy? Why don't you tell me about it? He should have been like, fuck you, get out of here right now. Like, don't come in here again anytime soon. So my lease was up in December, and I was ready to move back to Denver. It was just all of like the fun of living in New York City had totally evaporated. Like, I couldn't find a job. I was working at a KB Toys at a mall in New Jersey for the meanest woman I've ever met in my life, named Darlene, who had a braided rat tail. Just the worst times of my life. So my lease was up in December, and I was like, I'm getting the fuck out of here and going back to Denver. But then literally a week before I was supposed to move back, I just had this weird feeling. I was like, if I move back to Denver, I'm basically like chickening out and letting all of this like fear hype get to me, you know? Like, it's like everybody is moving away back to where they came from. I'm going to move into New York. I'm going to move into Brooklyn and live in Brooklyn instead of moving back to Denver. It was just a weird thought I had. I had to call my mom and tell her that. She was incredibly pissed. She put my grandma on the phone to try to talk me out of it. She's, I think, to this day, still pissed at how I toyed with her emotions like that. Like, hey, I'm coming home. And then, like, a week before, just kidding, I'm actually moving closer to all the danger that you imagine. See ya. And then I lived in New York for about a year after that, and it was terrifying. It was like the worst, probably mentally, time of my life I've ever had. I had so much anxiety. You know, like the media, they love to like spin fear. But like right after 9/11, if you lived in New York, you didn't have to like watch the news to feel afraid. You just knew that terrible things could happen. Like every time my subway car would be like hurtling under the East River underwater, I would just imagine like how little force you would need to detonate a bomb that would flood that tunnel with me in it. I probably drowned in a subway car under that tunnel in my mind about 600 times in that year I lived there, just constantly imagining it. And I only had one rule. I was like, if I ever... It was basically like this. Like, if I ever let my fear decide my actions and I actually change my behavior because of them, I'm going to move away from here. Because it's one thing to just be afraid in your head, you know, and just be like, oh, this is terrible, but it's okay. I'm just going to ride the train. And I was like, if I ever get off of a train or don't get on a train because I'm afraid, I'm going to move back. And finally, that night actually came. I was on a train coming home from work, and there was a guy across from me, and he had a big cardboard box with, like, black plastic bags, like, haphazardly, like, taped all over it. Just a really big box. Like, so big that it was like, how did he even get it into the subway in the first place? And he wasn't Middle Eastern. He was a black guy. But even then, you know, my head is like, in my mind, I'm replaying these, like, images of other terrorists from, like, Sudan and stuff. I'm like, terrorists can be black, too. They're not just Middle Eastern. There's no reason why this guy could not be a terrorist. And I'm just... And plus, like, there's this part of me who's, like, always been against racial profiling. So I'm like, you don't know who could have a dirty bomb on the subway. It could be anybody. It could be this, like, casually dressed black guy across from you. This could be a dirty bomb in this train. And I just got myself so worked up, I got off the train. Like, far, far away from where I was supposed to get off the train, I got off the train. And so then I decided to move away. I moved away really shortly after that, maybe like a month after that, and I moved back to Denver. Started doing stand-up comedy, a career that I'm still doing 8 years later, which led to this storytelling show that I would tell this very story on. So it all, like, has worked out. But when I think back to all the time I lived there, I stayed because I wanted to impress myself with how brave I could be. And then I spent the entire time being terrified up to the point when I racially profiled a stranger in a panic attack and got off a train. So I learned nothing. I didn't conquer anything. I just wanted to impress myself, but instead just suffered for a year, basically. And when I look back at that time, I'm still glad I did it. If I was like, if you could change that, what would you do differently? And then the weird thing is, and maybe I'll never know why this is, I wouldn't change it because it's just like an experience that I had. It's like a defining experience that is one of the shittier experiences of my life. But in a way, it was still, you know, time well served for me. So I'm glad I did it. Your next storyteller is new to the show. She came highly recommended. She's a PhD student at the University of Colorado in Boulder. This is Colleen Hackett.
This is my story about serving time, literally serving time in the county jail. And I can certainly delve into what I believe are the reasons why I ended up serving just under 1 year at the Hampden County Correctional Center in Massachusetts. You know, a bad luck childhood, crappy circumstances, a no good boyfriend. But I'm just going to get right down to it. Beginning at the age of 18, I was a heroin addict. And I lived on the streets. I slept in stairwells and parking garages and public buses because no one would have a heroin addict in their home. And I certainly couldn't hold down a job to pay for my heroin and an apartment. So for money, I stole electronic goods from big box corporate stores, which will all remain nameless, just in case I'm missing some charges on my criminal record. I don't want to out myself right now. But I scored some drugs from really sketchy people, really awful places. And I didn't think twice about the consequences. And all of these behaviors led to many, many arrests, many overnight stays at police stations, many appearances in front of many judges, multiple criminal charges, lots of slaps on the hand. And finally, after the umpteenth time of getting arrested, I found myself at the ripe young age of 22, shackled in the back of a paddy wagon on the way to the county jail to serve 1 year of my life as property of the state. So on the ride over, I just kept thinking that this couldn't be happening to me. You know, I'd always been a smart kid, hard worker, an overachiever. And sure, as a young punk, you know, I engaged in some sketchy criminal behaviors, but I didn't think that a jail sentence could ever happen to me, you know, a young, respectable person like myself. But sure enough, the police handed me over to the correctional guards. The guards did my intake and paperwork, and they searched my body for contraband, you know, the most humiliating thing ever. And they gave me my green cotton uniform with the county jail's stamp on the back, and they showed me to my cell, along with my crate full of county-issued hygiene products and my bleached white granny panties. And I was brought to a holding unit where I was to stay for 3 days for observation before being released to the general population, and I had no idea what to expect. You know, everything was so foreign to me. I didn't know the rules. I didn't know if I would have to fight someone. I didn't know if I was going to be someone's girlfriend. So I just spent that first evening in my cell by myself. And I didn't leave out, I didn't venture out one time to see who else was hanging. I was just so, you know, struck with fear. And I was physically sick from heroin withdrawals, which is a big deal. So lying down on that, you know, hard, uncomfortable bedding with the scratchy wool blend blanket seemed like the best option at the time. And so those next 3 days in that holding unit just seemed to be stringed together into like one hazy, continuous loop of eating and sleeping and staying in my cell, again, either out of fear or because I had no choice. The guards were doing their count of the inmates. But all I wanted to do was just get into general population, and I wanted to find someone, some non-intimidating person to interact with, you know, to get the lowdown on the rules, on how to stay out of trouble, and possibly how to score some dope, so, you know, that, which would help me with my withdrawals. And when that day came, I was transferred to a two-bunk cell, and I met my first cellmate, the first among many, Susan. She was a wiry, older, white lesbian. She was in for multiple counts of drug possession and larceny, too. And this had been her third time incarcerated, so she had been around the block. And she was pretty, you know, down with the street life, but also really nice. So I knew I could talk to her about, you know, all of my concerns. A lot of concerns being in jail for the first time. And she pretty much destroyed every assumption that I held up to that point. You know, assumptions that I had from watching television shows and movies about men in jail. Apparently, there were no race wars in women's jail. There were no daily stabbings. And no one was going to force me to be their girlfriend. And it was incredibly unlikely that I'd be able to score any dope, any good dope, for under, like, $100 a bag. So that wasn't going to happen. And she simply told me to just keep my nose out of other people's business, to get a laundry job so that I could keep my mind occupied, and to just do my time without making any trouble. And indeed, over the next year, most of my assumptions about hardened women criminals were entirely shaken. There was definitely a lot of gossip and drama to be had, but for the most part, the women were just concerned with finishing their sentences and getting back home to their families, if they had a family to return to. And in the meanwhile, when we were counting down our days to our release, many of us formed meaningful relationships, even if those friendships were quite clearly temporary. Some of the women taught me how to play card games, spades, with attitude. Others ran laps with me in our small little recreational area that was quite literally a cage. Other women talked shit with me about some of the crankier correctional guards. And other women would watch basketball games with me and scream at the television for their favorite player to score. And other women, usually the older ones, would tell me how beautiful of a person I was and how I needed to turn my life around before it was too late, before I was 10 years deep into my drug habit instead of 4 years, before I was 20 years deep in my abusive relationship instead of 5 years, and before I was 30 years deep in hustling stolen goods on the streets, or even worse, hustling my body. And the most important thing that I learned about the experiences of being a woman in jail, something that will always remain very close to me, was the amount of heartbreak that happened behind those barbed wire fences. There were countless mothers that I met who were horribly hurt by the separation from their children. And this was the most troubling thing to them. Some of the mothers could rest a little easier because their children were staying with family members. But others felt a different sort of loss because their children were taken into custody by social services and placed into foster care for a countless number of reasons. And worse yet, some mothers had to permanently sign over their custodial rights. One mother, Valerie, ran to me the same day she received the notification that her child was to be placed up for adoption, and she'd no longer be able to visit or talk to her son ever, ever again. And the image I have of her face on that day, a face that was so full of sadness and shame and regret, is an image that I will never, ever forget. And these experiences of sharing moments with women in jail, both beautiful and horrible, are what drive me to be a better person. I owe my motivation for living, basically, for living a clean life to these women. Also my inspiration for going to graduate school and studying these very issues. So to all of the women that I met within that 1 year, and to all the women I continue to meet who have been incarcerated at some point, this is my story for them. So thank you.
Up next, one of my favorite comedians ever, not just one of my favorite comedians, 5280 Magazine named him best comedy personality in Denver. He's a great friend and a great storyteller. This is Ben Roy.
I lived in Maine for a long time, and I went through a particularly bad breakup with a girlfriend that had cheated on me, which I totally deserved. By that point, I had kind of given up on myself. I was drinking a lot, and I had become verbally abusive, and I was not a good person. And so when she finally left me, I just used that as an excuse to kind of hurl myself further off the fucking deep end. And it was at, like, my deepest, lowest moment after she broke up with me that I had decided, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to move somewhere else. You know, I'm going to move somewhere new, because that's a good idea. I thought, you know, I mean, why not move somewhere new and introduce people somewhere else to the shittiest person you've been in the history of you, right? So I decide I'm going to move across country, and I get in my car with $80, and I drive to Colorado. And, of course, when I get out here, I don't change. I've just found a new environment to act like a gigantic asshole in. And in 2 weeks, I wrecked my car drunk driving. I hadn't found a job. I was down to, like, my last $5 or something. And I ended up getting a job at a convenience store working late nights, which was perfect because I could eat for free. And it was by CU Boulder, which meant that I could meet women. And I was excited. And I was like, fuck yeah, I'm going to meet a new girl. But women didn't want to have anything to do with me because women, like certain breeds of dogs, can sense when a person is seizing. And these women could tell that I was just fucking completely seized up. I was worthless. And it was at one of those late night shifts that I first met Hillary. Hillary was sitting in front of the convenience store with, like, two duffel bags, like, everything she owned in bags sitting beside her. And I went out to smoke a cigarette, and I got to talking with her. And Hillary was 18 years old. She was from South Florida, had just gone on a Greyhound bus and drove all the way across country and rode all the way across country to escape a really bad relationship and destructive relationship and abusive with this abusive guy that she called and everybody referred to as murder, which, wow, awesome, right? I mean, that's a great, I should preface this by saying, I love troubled women. I've always loved troubled women. Like, I'm glad I wasn't born a woman, and that's not misogynistic. It's just that had I been born a woman, I would have ended up a fucking drug mule or something. I would have been caught in Singapore with 4 pounds of heroin in my lower intestine. Look for love, right? And so she tells me that she just left this guy named Murder, which is, and you guys can put two and two together how he got that lovely nickname. But needless to say, I fell in love with her right then. And my recollection of Hillary is that she was this short, cute, free spirit who danced to the beat of her own drummer and was swimming against the current of life across this great landscape to be near the mountains, right? But my friends who remember to that time period said that she was a hideous pig monster skinhead who looks like she had been dragged behind a sand truck all the way across the country. I mean, she was fucking awful. And I believed them. I mean, I still think she's cute in my head, but everybody was like, no, not the case, because apparently back then, when everybody would get drunk and put beer goggles on, I got drunk and flipped the visor down on a fucking welding mask, because I was so horny and in need of affection from somebody. We started hanging out a lot. She stayed on her couch. She didn't have anywhere to live. We didn't have a car, so like I would just drive everywhere, and we'd walk and talk, and in all fairness, she was a good person. Like, she was just in a really bad situation, and she had walked into an even worse one with me because I was just in a shitty spot. One day she shows up. I'm at work on a rare day shift, and she tells me that she had spoke to her parents and to her ex-boyfriend, and she decided that she was going to move back. And it fucking crushed me because she had just been complaining about how awful these people were. And now she's going to move back. But I didn't want to let on my sadness. I didn't want her to push me away. So I was like, it's fine. Yeah, no, I support whatever you're happy with. But I was devastated. And so I told her, I'm getting off early that night. Why don't we go back to my place and we'll party and send her off. And so I showed up that evening and we proceed to get wasted. And by we, I of course mean me. So I start to get fucking annihilated. And I went through like one 40-ounce big gulp of Sprite and vodka, and then another 40-ounce big gulp of Sprite and vodka. And then I started on a 40-ounce beer, and that's where my evening ends. And I remember nothing after that. It's black. And my next memory is waking up, and my head is pressed against some painted cement blocks. I'm laying on my side, and I've got my arms pulled into my shirt because I'm freezing, and the light is on. And I look up at the ceiling, and I'm like, oh, shit, that's not my fucking light. And then I realize the light has a metal grate over it. And then I lean over and look, and there's a reinforced door. And I'm like, holy fuck, I'm in jail. And I have no clue as to what the hell just happened. And I woke up, and I'm, holy fuck, what did I do? And I go to stand up, but I immediately fall over because I'm still so drunk. And I'm on the edge of an epic hangover, and the guard sees me flailing around in this holding cell, and he opens the door, and I'm like, please tell me what I did. And he just kind of drags me out and fingerprints me, and he starts taking my photo, and I'm like, please, what the fuck did I do? What am I here for? And then he starts walking me down this hallway by some windows, and I'm like, okay, wait, no, I'm going home. I'm going home, right? I was just here to detox. And he opens up the door to this nondescript room, and in there it's blank, and there's just a bench, and on that bench is an orange uniform that says Boulder County Corrections. And I'm like, whoa, that's not for me, is it? I'm not wearing that. And he's like, take off all your clothes and put that on. And I was like, holy shit, like, what the fuck did I do? And he's like, take off all your clothes and put them on, or I will put them on for you. And so I get naked and I bend over and do the whole Shawshank Redemption thing, and he searches me, and it's humiliating, and I put this suit on, and then he starts walking me out to this big pod of cells, and he opens the door, and there's another guard in there, and he's like, get in that cell with the door open. And I'm like, please tell me what the fuck I did, please. And he's like, get in the cell. And I'm like, please. And then he reminded me that I was a little bitch, which I completely fucking forgot about up until this point. So he's like, get in the goddamn cell. And so I back in, and I'm like, please tell me what I did. And then he shuts the door, and I'm stuck in this cell now. And people always talk about how fucking loud jail is. But until you've really been to jail, you don't know. It's really, people just fucking yell for no reason because they have nothing else to do. They just yell. And I'm trying to piece together the night's events, and I'm hungover, and people are just screaming. I felt like I was trying to do a huge jigsaw puzzle in the canine section at the Humane Society because nobody fucking will shut up. And I'm sitting there, and now I start to get nervous because it's like 4 feet of walls by like 6 feet. And I have that post-drunk bowel movement coming. So I go to shit in the toilet, and I shit. And then I look over, and there's no toilet paper. There's just a little brown roll from a toilet paper. So I'm like, my first jail humiliation. And I rip that up, and I wipe myself with that and flush that, which doesn't work all that well, by the way. And so I get up, and I pace for 2 hours, no word. And then finally the door opens, and there's a woman. They call my name, and there's a woman in a tan suit and a briefcase sitting out there. And I was like, oh, shit, this person must know why I'm here. And so she calls me out. She's my caseworker from the county. And she's like, all right, so are you curious? Are you wondering? I'm like, please tell me what the hell happened. And she's like, sit down. You know, you're not, I don't know what to tell you. And I'm like, please tell me what the fuck I did. And she's like, you want to know what you're charged with? And I was like, yes. She's like, you're charged with use of fighting words. And I was like, what the fuck is use of fighting words? And she's like, use of fighting words. And of course, she fills in that it's only a crime in Boulder County. That's the only place that you can be charged with Boulder, in Boulder, is use of fighting words. It's a municipal infraction. It's the same as jaywalking or spitting, right? It's an add-on crime. And she proceeds to piece together my Mad Lib night of an evening where apparently we were hanging out getting drunk, Hillary and I. We started fooling around. I got filled with emotions, which at that point in my life I was allergic to, and I started flipping the fuck out and throwing shit around the apartment. I was holding her down on the couch and screaming in her face. I broke my roommate's VCR. The neighbors called the cops, and I went cops highlight reel on them when they came in. I was like, I know my First Amendment rights, okay? You can't come into my apartment while I'm doing experiments. And whatever, I just rattled off a bunch of garbage that made no sense. And they were so pissed at me that they wanted to take me to jail, but Hillary, being a skinhead, hated cops, and so wouldn't press any charges. So they charged me with what they could, which is me trying to incite them to violence, which is use of fighting words, right? So what they did was they handcuffed me, took my wallet, took every bit of money I had, threw it on my bed, put my wallet back in my pocket, and took me to jail. And that's when the court clerk tells me that my bond is only $50. And I'm like, okay, well, I should have that on my person. Oh, wait, the cops, in their infinite wisdom, had taken every bit of money I had out of my wallet because they didn't want me to bail myself out. So then I tell them, okay, call my roommates, okay? And I'll call my parents. Called them both, but given my previous month's behavior and how I had gone off the deep end, they were like, just fucking leave him in there. My other roommate was like, he broke my VCR. I don't want to talk to him. So he left me in the cell. And so she just sends me back. And about another hour and a half later, they open my cell again. And I come out, and they're like, supply call. And so I go out to get my supplies. And I walk out, and they're like, what do you need? And I was like, I need toothpaste, toothbrush, and toilet paper. And he's like, okay, bring me the little brown roll. And I was like, oh, okay, wait a second. I don't have the brown roll because when I went in there, I had to go to the bathroom, and so I used that. And he's like, I can't give you another roll of toilet paper unless you bring me the brown roll. It's contraband. And I was like, okay, you're not getting this, though. I used that to wipe my ass with, and I flushed it down the toilet. And he's like, well, too bad. I'm not going to give you another roll of toilet paper unless you bring me the brown roll. And I was like, well, what am I supposed to do? And he's like, figure it out. And he left me with no toilet paper. But he said I could take a book. So I see that they have books. And I picked Tom Clancy's classic, The Hunt for Red October. Because my dad, who wouldn't bail me out of jail, is a huge Tom Clancy fan. And I'd wipe my ass with that, right? So then I start walking with my book back. And I'm like, I'll just wipe my ass with this book until the fucking guard bellows back to me that if he finds a page missing out of the book, that he'll make my life very uncomfortable. Which, I don't know what that means, but I didn't test him because he's the one that makes the doors open and close. So I believed him. Then they shut the door, and that's when it hits me. I was in the cell, and it's Saturday morning. And I realized that Boulder doesn't have court on Saturday or Sunday, and Monday was Labor Day. So I was stuck in that cell from Friday night till Tuesday, reading Tom Clancy and wiping my ass with my fucking hand for 4 days. I did that, which I'm not sure which one is worse, Tom Clancy or wiping my hand. The jury's still out on that. And you say, hey, what's it like to wipe your ass with your own hand for 4 days? It's like digging feces out of your own ass crack. That's what it is. And you say, hey, Ben, at least it's your own feces. Well, that's the funny thing about feces. It doesn't know any owner. It's fucking disgusting regardless of what it is. So Tuesday comes around, and I go to court, and the judge calls me up, tells me what I'm charged with. I'm found guilty, and I'm given time served. And I went home and looked online and found that I had actually served a day more than the actual maximum penalty that use of fighting words hands you. It's 3 days. I spent 4 days in jail. I also came home to find out that my job had fired me. My boss had fired me from my job, and my landlord had evicted me, just me, from the apartment because of my antics that prior few weeks. I was also told that Hillary got on a bus that day prior to me getting out and went back to Florida. Never seen her again. I don't know what happened to her. Don't care. And by don't care, I mean I can't remember her last name, so I can't find her on Facebook. But I like the story to me because I got up with time served, and it's always been strange to me that after that point, I changed a lot. I stopped drinking as much. I started working out and eating better. I started, like, running a lot, and it was always strange that it was in a room where there was no mirrors that was so loud that I was finally able to see and hear what it was that I sounded like. Thank you.
Your next storyteller is a teacher and a stand-up comedian. He's headlining the Comedy Works on September 21st. Please welcome Chris Voth.
I lived here in Denver for a few years, and I bought a condo. Not a very good idea, but I bought one. And then I decided, because I was a comedian, and I had started out in L.A., and I moved to Denver. Also, not a great career move, but that's what I decided to do. And I bought this condo, and right after I bought it, I moved to San Francisco because for whatever reason. And I was there, and I was waiting tables and telling jokes, etc., and got on the show Last Comic Standing. I did not win, obviously. I wouldn't be here on Andrew's show. No, I'm kidding. I probably would. Anyway, so I was there, and I got on that show, and I got on a couple episodes. No big deal. But they had taped it, but I wasn't on TV yet. So I had kind of worked out this other thing, and I got this job after years and years of working, doing stand-up full-time, or basically stand-up full-time, working with an improv group. And so I got this full-time job, and I knew that I had that, and I could move back down to L.A. and try to make it. And that was like my dream. I know you think of shooting higher than that, but that's what I was hoping for. And so it's the summer of a few years ago, and I moved out of my apartment. I'm waiting for the couple episodes to air where I'm going to be on TV, and then I'm going to move down to L.A., and I'm going to have this job. and I'm going to be a huge star because that's really what it's all about, right? And then I meet this girl, and of course it's like this, like a whatever story, that girl that she was like the, not of my dreams because I don't think I would have dreamed this high, but she was beautiful and funny and really smart. Again, no, anyway, so just was completely in love with this girl immediately, and so I was torn because I don't have a place to live. I'm kind of hanging out on people's couches, and now this girl, and I really need to move out to L.A. and whatever, and we start hanging out. It was just amazing, just incredible. I wanted to be with her every day, and I don't even like people, and I wanted to be her around her all the time. We're hanging out, and then she says, you know, it's really not going to work out. It's not going to, I don't know what it is, but it's just not going to work out. I'm not ready to date anybody. So I'm in this situation. I'm heartbroken and think, what do I do? Do I just go, or do I stay? I decided to stay. I decided to stay in San Francisco. I got another apartment and I in her neighborhood. Not too close, but just close enough. Stuck around a few months. We didn't talk for a few months. And then she called me and said she missed me and wanted to hang out, whatever. We started hanging out and everything was great again. And it was just this, it was like everything was right. You just, when you know you meet the right person, you think this is exactly the way it should be. And this goes on for quite some time. But she keeps saying, you know, I'm just not sure we're ready to date, but, you know, whatever. Let's just, you know, hang out. Keeps it every day. And it's just amazing. But the next summer I go and I do a show out in New York and I come home and we were sitting in the park talking and she says, yeah, I just decided now I'm ready to start dating. I mean, I've been through a whole lot and I'm ready to start dating. Not you, but I am ready to start dating, and so I feel good about that. I think, great, that's terrific for you. So I'm out of here because I'm going to move to L.A. because I'm going to be a huge star. I don't know if you heard about my plans, but I've mentioned them a few times. So I move out of my apartment, and I'm doing my last couple weeks of work. They asked me to work a couple extra days. During those last couple days, she calls me, of course. I haven't mentioned her name, have I? Yeah, good. I just try to remember if I said Megan's name or not. But anyway, so she starts talking, same sort of deal. You know, I miss you. I realize you're the person I should be with and all that. I think, you know, I just moved out of my apartment, and I'm moving to L.A., you know, to do my thing. And I think, well, I'm going to give it another shot. So I get another apartment. And, you know, this is San Francisco. You can't just keep getting apartments, but I guess you can. They got a lot of them there. And we start dating. It's great, and it's exactly what you hope. I can't believe how much I love this girl and want to be with her all the time. And as I said, I don't like people. I don't like to be around them very much. But this girl, I want to be around all the time. And it was amazing. And my travel schedule's a little rough for us because I'm always on the road. I was flying around a lot. She said, you know, it's just not really working so much if you're always gone. We really need to be together more. And I think, yes, that's what I want. I want to be together more. So she said, so I'm not saying you have to quit the improv group. I'm just saying we can't be together if you're still in the improv group. Good. At least it wasn't an ultimatum. So I give them notice. I give them a couple months to find someone else. We get to the end of that summer, and I actually had a stand-up gig besides that. And last week of my gig, I have no job. Don't know what I'm going to do, but I know I'm in love with this girl. And she says after I opened for Linda Ronstadt, if it matters at all, but name dropping for the older crowd. Afterwards, she says, you know, it's just not going to work out. I mean, I know you just quit your job and stuff, but it's just not going to work. It's just not, I don't know what it is. It just doesn't feel right. And I was going to do a lame Linda Ronstadt joke, but why do it here? So I was, of course, devastated, heartbroken, and my condo was sitting empty at the time in Denver, and I just said, you know, I'm out of here. I'm out of this town. I'm going to leave. So I moved back to Denver and was here and was struggling just with the idea of the whole thing. I was just so devastated. I've never been like this. You know, I don't know if you get that low point. And I'll be honest, it just sounds sort of cheesy and like I'm trying to be funny, but I got to the point the following year. It's done one night when I realized I couldn't do it anymore. I was just in such pain, such heartbroken, and actually considered ending it. Actually, not considering it. I made the plans and that sort of thing. That weird moment of the night, and I'm sure many of you have probably not had that moment, but where you try to think if you have enough pills or if you're going to have to go to Walgreens, and if they're still open. And if you're going to have to Google Walgreens and figure out which one's still open, it's sort of weird. And then I did the dishes because I didn't want my mom to see that I had dirty dishes in the sink. All true, by the way. And I did call my mom in weird circumstances, if you believe in God or fate or whatever. But there was a friend came over and stopped me from doing whatever I was going to do. More cleaning, probably, before I took the pills. But anyway, it's just I was so devastated. It was just heartbroken. And over the next few months, it didn't get better necessarily. It just sort of faded out a little bit. And I went through bankruptcy and foreclosure. A lot of fun things were going on for me, really doing well. And you think those would turn into good jokes, but they haven't. So a year or so goes by. It's now been about 2 years since I've seen her, and I get a call. Of course I get a call. And she says... And it's like just out of a movie you wouldn't believe it was like this. I was doing a show in Northern California. She borrowed a car, drove 3 hours to see me, and just poured out her heart saying she was totally wrong. She went to Paris and got engaged with a 3-carat diamond ring or something, realized it's wrong. She had to be with me. She had... So, and I'm just thinking, wow, this is the same girl who was mad because I didn't have a boat. And I didn't have a boat. Still don't. And, you know, those how those girls are in San Francisco. And... Well, this one. So, and I'm thinking, how do I let this person get back? And I'm like, I can't do this, but this is someone I love, and I just knew it was right, and I just couldn't believe it finally had worked out. And she said, I'm going to move out to Colorado. So she flew out a couple weeks later, and we spent time together. I wanted to show her a good time. I took her to the stock show. We did it, you know, we did everything. We did everything. And in a moment of weakness, and I should have never done this, but in a moment of weakness, I actually told her about that night when I got so, was so heartbroken. I thought, this is at least she needs to know. If you're going to come back in my life and we're going to be together and make this work, you've got to know how low this was for me. And I told her, and I explained it, and I'm sure I was crying or something, or at least emotional. And I remember her saying, oh, I can't believe this happened to me again. And I'm like, wait. She goes, yeah, this every guy I've dated since college has said the same thing. So, which is, you know, what you want to hear at that moment when you've opened yourself up, that not only does she not care, but what you've just said is pretty hacky. And so, but we're still, you know, still, like I said, there's never been a moment in my life where I thought, this is for sure the person I'm going to be with. And I don't want to make it like a sad, like sort of a love story. Oh, it ends great, because it doesn't, because 2 weeks later she called and said, it's just... it's not going to work out. I don't know what it is, but it's not going to work out. And it's funny to someone in the back. But and it's like years and years of like, I can't believe I have spent so many years wasted in emotional jail, if I can tie it in that way, tied up to this girl. And less than a year later, she was married to someone else. And there's no sort of like, I wish there was like a happy ending where I'd feel great about it. But as Andrew said, I teach high school here in Denver, not... a big star in L.A., and that's sort of the way it goes. But I think if there's one little, small little thing, is that her new last name is Cox. Should be Cunts, but that's another... And she... so for the rest of her life, she's going to have to tell people, yeah, Cox, yeah, like the dicks, multiple penises, right. And I don't know if that makes it better at night or not for me, but it's something. So, thank you.
Your next storyteller is a veteran stand-up comedian. He performs all over the country as his alter ego, Hippie Man. But tonight, this is his secret identity. This is John Novosad.
Thank you very much. You know, and I'm glad that Andrew mentioned that I'm a stand-up comic, because there's a couple of things that you need to know about this story. I'm a stand-up comic. I work all across the country. I've traveled extensively. And also, this story took place in 1999. And so this is a story about me being on the road as a stand-up comic. And the thing about being on the road is that I've had some really great times and experiences on the road, and I've had some times that were not so good. And this is a story that was not so good, being on the road, you know? And part of it had to do with the town that I was in. And it's because I didn't like this town that much, and I've been to the town a couple times, and it's Houston, Texas. And, you know, I mean, but I'm just saying, you know, there's a couple of things about that town that I don't like. And one of them is the weather, you know, and it's like, I've been there in the summer, and it's sweltering hot, and it fucking rains like this crazy, you know, deluge of rain, and it's just not my favorite place to go. But the story starts, like I say, in 1999, and I'm in Beaumont, Texas. And man, if you think Houston is bad, you know, spend some time in Beaumont, and you'll fucking like Houston. But I'm in Beaumont, Texas, and I'm on the road. And the thing about being on the road is sometimes you have off nights. So I was like, wow, I've got to do a showcase in another town to try to get work at another club, and that's like a free set. So I go, I rent a car, I go to Houston. It's a Sunday night. My friend Patrick Candelaria is headlining the club. I see that he's headlining the club. I've never worked this club. I'm doing just a little 10-minute set to try to get work. I'm going, fucking Patrick will run some interference for me. It'll be good. I get to this club. It's called the Comedy Corner. They're all the comedy something, the Comedy Shack, the comedy this, the comedy that, and it's the Comedy Corner. So I get there, and literally there are not enough people to do a show, actual paying customers. And so I'm in my mind, I'm like, man, I paid this money to rent a car. I rented a hotel room. I'm not going to get shit out of this. You know, there's no show. But the guy who owns the club is named Bobby Hedges, and he has seen me in Dallas, Texas. And he goes, man, I've seen your show. I will book you. I like you. And I'm like, shit, you know, all right, I'm winning. So, well, I didn't mean it like that, like a Charlie Sheen reference. But anyway, I'm winning, you know, and then I'm in a sitcom, and it got really weird. No, that's not what happened. But anyway, so the guy says to me, I'll book you. And he goes, when are you going to be in Dallas? Because he saw me in Dallas. He's like, when the next time you're going to be in Dallas? I go, the second and third week in June of this year. So I'm there like in March. I'm going to be there in June. He goes, I'll tell you what. I have a hypnotist the last week in June and the first week in July. I will book you to open for that guy and pay you $500 a week and put you up in a hotel. And I'm like, all right, that's great. That'll be great. You know, I can tie it in with Dallas. I'll do 2 weeks in Dallas, 2 weeks in Houston. I'll make money. It'll be great. I'm working with a hypnotist. The thing I should tell you about opening for a hypnotist is that the crowds are there to see the hypnotist, and they don't give a shit about you as the comic. You know, so you go up and eat it, and then the hypnotist comes up and does his thing. This club is a big club, man. It's like 400 seats. The show runs Wednesday through Sunday. I finish up my week in Dallas. Things are good. I had a good week, couple weeks in Dallas. I go into Houston. I fly into Houston. Somebody from the club is there to pick me up. Things are looking good. You know, lots of times you get to a place, nobody's there to pick you up. You got to call the club. Shit's looking good. The hotel room is good. Everything is good. So Wednesday night, first show, I go up there. It's a 400-seat room. We have like 30 people. I'm like, wow, all right. I'm a trooper. I go up and I do my 30 minutes. This crowd hates me. I mean, I just eat it like a plow horse for 30 minutes. I mean, they fucking do not like me at all. And I'm like, all right, you know, but I'm a trooper, man. I do my 30 minutes and I bring up this guy, and it's the hypno bro. I swear to God, it's true. The hypno bro. He's a black hypnotist. And the only thing that's different about a white hypnotist and a black hypnotist, at least in this particular case, is he's the fucking hypno bro. But he still brings up, like, you know, 8 or 10 people in a chair, you know, chairs behind you, and he does this whole process of elimination thing where, like, 3 or 4 of them go back into the crowd that he can't hypnotize, and he has, like, 5 people that he hypnotizes, and he does the thing. So I do my 30 minutes. They hate me. I bring him up. He does his show. It's okay. But what was weird about it to me is there's literally like 30 people in the audience, and he's bringing like 10 of them up there. You know, he's taking a third of the audience and bringing them up and hypnotizing them. And I was like, fuck, tell them to like me, you know. But anyway, so the first night, you know, I go, all right, that's all right. It's the first night. It was a little bit weird, but I'll be okay. And so, you know, the thing is the guy, Bobby, really did put me up in a nice hotel. And there was like a restaurant, a couple of restaurants nearby. There's a movie theater nearby. So it's not that bad. I mean, it's Houston, the end of June, really hot. But I go on my little routine. I go to the restaurant, get coffee, have a meal, go watch a shitty movie from 1999 at the Cineplex, go back to my hotel room and get ready for Thursday. I go, Thursday's got to be better, you know? But Thursday wasn't better. It fucking sucked again, man. There's 40 people. I eat it. They literally, I feel like I'm speaking another language to these people. They don't get me at all. I don't get them. But I bring up the hypno bro. He takes a third of the audience again. It's like Groundhog's Day, man. It's just, it happens all over again, you know. I go up at the end, say goodnight. And usually, you know, at a comedy club, when you're working out of town, you make friends with somebody, the locals or whatever. You go out for drinks or whatever. I'm eating it so bad, like, nobody fucking wants to hang out with me. So I go back to my hotel room, and I repeat the whole process again. The next morning, I get up, I go to the restaurant, have breakfast, coffee, go watch another shitty 1999 movie, come back. It's Friday. There's two shows. I'm like, it's the weekend. It's got to be better. It sucked again, man. It really did. I mean, sure, it's Friday. There's a few more people. The crowds are like 50 instead of 30, but it's still sucking. So Saturday comes along, fucking suck fest again, man. They don't like me at all. Sunday, even fewer people, 20 people. You know, he's bringing up half the crowd, which is funny to me, but I'm just eating it. And so Sunday, you know, is the night you get paid. I still have a week to go. I have a week to go. And I'm like, this is just horrible. So, you know, in my little routine of going to the restaurant and going to shitty movies, I took some time to call the airlines and go, hey, if I fly back on this Monday instead of next Monday, what will it cost me? And they're like, $75. I go, okay, I'm going to keep that on hold. The guy pays me Sunday night, Bobby, the guy who owns the club. I'm like, Bobby, you know what, man? I so appreciate you bringing me in here. I've never done this, but I looked into it. It's going to cost me $75 to go home. You can get a local guy to do this shit, need it for 30 minutes, save some money, and, you know, we'll just call it good. I think Bobby is going to, like, jump on this deal, you know, but Bobby goes, hey, man, stay. You know, stay for the other week. He goes, I'm a comic. I will go up in front of you and do, like, 5 minutes and then bring you up. I need to check my watch, but we're good. Okay, so so he says, I'll do, you know, 5 minutes in front of you. I will bring you up. You do 30 minutes. I'll bring up the Hypno Bro. We'll be good. I'm like, okay, great. He convinces me to stay. Wednesday rolls around. Now, I've already had Monday and Tuesday to do my, you know, I'm running out of movies at the Metroplex, although I did see that Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, like 3 times just because I didn't know what else to do. I had run out of movies to see. So Wednesday rolls around, fucking eat it, eat it, eat it, all the way across the board. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. It's worse. I mean, I could not have made, you know, a worse choice by staying. I mean, my shows suck. Even with the lead-in from Bobby, they fucking hated me. They wanted the Hypno Bro. It was still 30 people a show. I'm eating it. The last night is a Sunday night. It's July 4th. I'm not a religious person by any stretch of the imagination. I said a prayer, man. And here's what it was. Bobby Hedges had a rule that it was like 15 people minimum for a show. It's the day of the 4th of July in this sweltering heat. I literally said a prayer and said, you know what? I have jumped through every fucking hoop for the last 2 weeks and done these shows for, you know, small crowds in Houston that hate me in front of the Hypno Bro. Please, God, let there be less than 15 people. And well, I don't think I used God. I just said, please, let there be less than 15 people. And whoever is in charge said, all right, fucker, 15 people, 4th of July. And I ate it the worst of the 2 fucking weeks. It was like somebody feeded me the cheese wheel of shit for July 4th. And I was like, all right, I have met, you know, whatever I needed to meet here. And I arranged for a shuttle to pick me up the next morning. And I was flying out early because after... And here's a good piece of advice. If you ever spend 2 weeks in Houston, fly out early because you'll fucking appreciate that just that much more. I swear to God, I did feel like I was being released from prison or a hostage that was being set free after those 2 weeks in Houston. And the beauty of it was I came back to Denver after a month on the road and eating it for those 2 weeks. And then when I got a show in Denver, I rocked it because I worked so fucking hard on the time served in Houston. Thank you very much.
Your next storyteller actually just agreed to do this show yesterday, pulling me out of a pinch. He's one of my oldest friends. He's an artist who does art shows all over the world, pretty much. This is Ravi Zuppa.
Okay, all right. My story takes place about 10 years ago in a little house in the DU neighborhood, and I actually at the time lived with Andrew Orvidal and another friend of ours named Matt. And so we were kind of the staples of the house. We were always there. It was a great time to live together and everything. It was like I said, 10 years ago, we were young. It was like fun. But and there was always this rotating cast of, you know, like other roommates. So at one point, we had some vacancy. Somebody was moving out, and we didn't know anybody to replace them. So Andrew got on Craigslist and posted that we were looking for a roommate. And, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever done that, but it can be complicated at times. So in our case, we didn't have... I don't know. Andrew was doing the whole thing, but what we ended up doing was going with this guy who was walking across the United States, and so we didn't meet him beforehand. And so that's, you know, normally you, like, meet the person, but I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't have mattered. Anyway, so, okay, here's the story. He's going from Georgia, from the coast. He's, like, touching the beach in Georgia and walking to the beach in San Francisco the whole way, and he was not going to take a ride ever. So that's his goal. So, but obviously, you can't make the whole thing. So he's going, you know, you can't do it in one go. So it's 4 months from Georgia to Denver, and then it's wintertime, and if he tried to walk across the Rocky Mountains, he would die, obviously. So he instead wanted to just stay in Denver for 3 months. And so that was the time period that he needed a place to stay. So we're like, all right, cool. This sounds neat. Andrew was corresponding with him, and he seemed like a nice dude. And what this is sort of interesting, you know, somebody wants to do that. It's probably kind of neat, whatever. So we're like, all right, cool. So time comes. This guy arrives. His name is Chris. Chris arrives, and, you know, he's a totally nice dude. He's just, like, tall, kind of... a little bit goofy, totally friendly, whatever. So that first night, we were all hanging out. It was like Andrew and Matt and myself hanging out in the kitchen, just talking, cracking jokes, and listening to his stories about what, you know, what the road is like when you're walking. And, you know, most of it is, like, eccentric characters that he's meeting and, like, do you listen to Walkman? No, I just listen to my own thoughts. And, you know, he's like this hippie type or whatever. So so then he gets to this one story where he says something happened in some town where he had to stay for like a week or something. And it wasn't, I don't remember the details of why, but he wasn't going to walk for some time period. And so he made an arrangement with some woman to stay in her trailer home where she lived. And he was going to kick her some money and just sleep on the couch. And... so he gave her money and then went to the house. And then the first night, out of nowhere, this fucking maniac woman, just a crazy person, just he's settling in, like laying down on the couch, whatever. This woman comes in out of nowhere and says, this isn't going to work. You need to leave. Throws the money at him, says, like, you got to go. You can't stay here. This isn't going to work. And he's like, what the fuck? I don't know. You know, totally can't understand why. You know, asked to go out in the cold, and he doesn't, you know, have any place to go or whatever. And we're like, oh, this is confusing, you know? And we're all sort of like, oh, what do you think it was? You know, like, what? And it's not, like, at all clear. And then, and he doesn't have an answer, and he's sincere. I think he really genuinely didn't know why. And then he told another story that was remarkably similar of, like, the first night, like, somebody saying, like, oh, yeah, you know what? I mean, I think later it was some dude who was, and this was another town, and that guy's, like, gives him some story that seems not true, like something, like he's coming up with a story why it's not going to work. He's like, yeah, you know, I really did want you to stay, but I mean, it's not going to work, whatever. So he has to leave again. And so we're all kind of like, oh, it's kind of odd. You know, you meet somebody who's like, you know, I have been fired from, like, 9 jobs in a month, and I didn't even do anything. And you're like, oh, there's something missing, obviously. But I really do think that he didn't know. He was being really sincere, and I'll get to that later on in the story. So, whatever. We didn't see anything obvious that night. We didn't flip out of nowhere and say, this isn't going to work. Just went to bed, whatever, you know, regular life. So the next day, I come home in the evening, and from work, I don't know. Anyway, I come home, and I walk in the back door, and the back door is connected to the kitchen. And when I come in, there is this unbelievable stench that just fucking hits me in the face. And, like, unbelievable. I cannot tell you the fucking smell. And so I go into the kitchen, which is where the back door is sort of connected to. And Andrew's in the kitchen cooking, like, macaroni and cheese or something. And I was like, what the fuck are you cooking? That is, like, not edible. There's no chance that you can put that in your body. It smelled like somebody climbed on the stove and shit in his pot and then, like, let it simmer and fill the house with its aroma. So I was like, dude, I don't know. You can't eat fecal matter. It's not safe. And Andrew is fucking somber and, like, already in this situation that I'm walking into. And he says, no, dude, that's his fucking feet. And I was like, what the fuck do you mean that's his feet? Did he shit on his feet and then walk around the kitchen or something? So I was just like, oh, okay. So I walk in the living room, and he's laying on his back on the couch, like just like so comfortable, spread out with his feet like crossed on the armrest, and he's eating. And it was like, all right. So yes, and I'm definitely like approaching the hot zone. This is what the shit. This is where this is coming from. And the possibility that he shit on his feet seems a little bit, you know, likely. It's like he's this hippie type who's like, hey man, toilets are for squares. What do I need a toilet for when I got feet? I just shit on them. So I'm like, all right. And as I'm walking, obviously, I'm computing last night's stories and going like, oh, this is very sensical. I know why this has happening, why these weird things happened to him. But I do think, like I said, I do think he was really sincere about not understanding the situation, because he's laying there totally relaxed, eating food, which, dude, if you fucking... I mean, you can't eat food, like, just gag. It can't put food in your mouth with that. He's very close to himself while he's eating. And this, like, and so anyway, I'm computing that. And then what he's eating is fucking amazing, and it's also sort of explaining something about this scene, because he's eating a box of, like, Ritz crackers. And do you know, have you seen those big blocks of Velveeta cheese? It's just, like, big fucking brick. It's like a brick. And then we found out that this is 100% of his fucking diet. And I'm not kidding you. I did not see him eat another thing. Andrew will corroborate this. This is fact. Like, never did I see him eat something else. It was like this weird knockoff Ritz, like generic brand Ritz cracker or whatever. It's like buttery, fucking flaky cracker and that kind of cheese that was like decaying in his body and then just secreting out of his feet. Anyway, so this is like, holy shit. You know, when we first had this shit on the internet and we're like, oh, okay, we don't get to meet him, shit. We don't get to like make sure he's not a psycho or whatever. But we're like, oh, 3 months, you know, what's the fucking, all right, he's a jerk. We could deal with 3 months. At this point, we're like, what the fuck? 3 fucking months? This is going to be a nightmare. So anyway, we kind of think like, all right, maybe it'll pass. Like, he's getting settled, needs to wash his body and his things. He's been walking for fucking 4 months with one pair of socks, fact, because he just wants to, like, travel light or something. And he's putting Ritz and Velveeta in his socks while he walks. So anyway, okay, so, you know, it's not really clear what to do in this situation, but some time passes, like a week or something, and the fucking house it just like takes over the whole house. And there's, when he's not there, it's like, oh, I'm gonna stick around, I'll just sit back here and fucking hold down the fort while you're gone. And it did. It was like in everything. You couldn't escape it anywhere in the house. So anyway, we're trying to think like, well, how do we deal with this? And like in this kind of situation, usually there's like, everybody's like, oh, you know, maybe we should talk to him. Maybe somebody, who's going to do it? I don't want to talk to him, you know? But we kind of had the opposite problem because, you know, it is kind of, you know, it is hard to think, like, how do you broach this with somebody? But luckily for us, we had three different ways. And because of, like, a lack of coordinating, organizing, we all broached this shit with him without knowing that we had all done it. So, like, I don't know how long it was before we, but we survived this for some time. And then Matt was the first one to talk to him, and Matt's like very gentle and like, you know, he's great. So he sat the guy down and he's like, you know, I don't know how he originally brought it up, but he says like, yeah, you know, I used to have really bad smelling feet, and then I figured out that I got a really scrub in the toes. So he's like coaching, giving him like tips on how to be a hygienic human being. And then like the next day, this shit happened. Like all three of us talked to this guy in the span of 2 days without knowing that we were doing this. And then Andrew was the next one, which is fucking wonderful. Andrew went to Target and like bought the dude a package of socks, like a dozen pairs or whatever. And that's how he's like, hey, I thought of you when I saw it. And he like gives him the socks and then like talks about how, you know, you gotta keep them washed and like wear whatever. And then what, I don't know, I was the last person to talk to him. And I'm not like them. I'm not like tactful and like gentle at all. I'm just like fucking harsh. And I don't, I mean, I'm just stupid. Like, I don't think of it as like, oh, you know, you gotta be like light or something. I'm just like, all right, dude, we gotta talk. There's like an issue in the house we need to talk about. And the fucking poor dude has had to have this conversation where he's like getting coached on how to be clean or whatever. Anyway, so I'm like all harsh with him. I think in the end, he moved out early. We didn't have to serve the full 3 month sentence because there was like, because he moved out because of our being oppressive jerks or whatever. And then he had to go on to tell somebody else that story, and I don't know how he told it in the future. Anyway, that's my story.
Well, that's it for our show. Thank you so much for listening. Next month's theme is Things I've Lost, and it's actually guest-hosted and guest-curated by Robert Rutherford, who is one of my favorite storytellers. So look for that in October, and I'll be back with the Narrator's mini-cast in a few weeks. So we'll see you then. Thanks again.